things. But I would say overarching is I wanted there to be a sense of optimism that although things are messed up and all these things are going on, if there's a fight with a clear way to win, if there's a fight going on, then that's the optimism, the hope right there. So I don't want to give away too much of what happens in the movie, but I, you know, it is a strange odyssey.
It certainly is. sorry to bother you, but we have to end. No, Boots Riley, writer and director of the acclaimed film Sorry to Bother You. Check it out. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Part two coming at democracynow.org.
Good afternoon. The time is 5 o'clock. You are listening to KBO Portland, and we're hoping you're keeping cool minds and cool bodies up there, out there in the world in PDX. Up next is your KBOO Evening News.
While in Atlanta, Danny Lyon joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and acted as staff photographer from 1962 to 1964. His first solo photography book, The Bike Riders, a study of outlaw motorcyclists, was published in 1968. Following his publication of The Bike Riders, Lyon completed documentary work on the Texas prison system. Lyon's work is very personal and gives us, the viewer, access to people and places we wouldn't normally get to see.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Danny Lyon film screening on Wednesday, July 18th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Danny Lyon will be in Portland to show the films Willie and Murderers. Again, that's the Danny Lyon film screening on Wednesday, July 18th at 7:30 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO has a tent set up at the Occupy ICE encampment in southwest Portland, where we are broadcasting and webcasting live reports from the camp.
Protesters have created a community of resistance since June 17th to protest the deportation and separation of families by the U.S.
U.S. Department of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE.
ICE, check our website for a schedule of upcoming broadcasts and listen to our past interviews at kboo.fm/OccupyICE.
KBOO.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a video has gone viral of Portland police telling a same-sex couple to ignore a man's verbally assaulting them with slurs and physical threats.
An overdue bill has finally been introduced that would make gay and trans panic illegal under federal law.
And in international news, the band Pussy Riot wins a case against the Russian government. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, July 17th, 2018. I'm Yasmin.
And I'm Kyle. A video has gone viral showing a man verbally assaulting a same-sex couple in Portland with threats of and homophobic slurs. Wendy and Trudy Dragoon were walking in their neighborhood in the Brenton-Darlington area Sunday evening when a truck started speeding towards them. The couple had found a lost dog and were attempting to find its owner. As they ran onto the sidewalk to avoid the vehicle, it abruptly turned around and parked in front of a nearby home. Three men exited the truck while one man approached them and verbally threatened to physically attack them. Wendy then began filming the altercation with her cell phone. In the video, which was later uploaded to Facebook, one man is seen as putting his fists at Trudy, who stands calmly in front of him. Although he does not swing, he goes on to call her a number of homophobic and sexist slurs. One of the other men, who tells Trudy he owns the nearby home, attempts to separate the two by standing between them, while the other man continues to accost the couple. Towards the end of the three-minute-long video, a police officer on patrol drives by and asks them what is going on. Trudy responds, quote, "He's harassing me," to which the man replies, "She won't get off my property." After this exchange, the video ends. Wendy later said that the Portland police officer's response was that the couple should just ignore the men accosting them with homophobic slurs.
The officer also allegedly told the couple that this was not considered a hate crime unless the man was physically violent. According to the couple, the police officer stated, quote, "being mean to you isn't against the law," unquote. However, under Oregon's hate crime law, even threatening to inflict physical injury is indeed considered a second-degree misdemeanor. The Dragoons also stated that around midnight that night, they could hear loud fireworks coming from the same property where the truck was parked. They walked outside to determine if it was the same home, but another neighbor was already outside calling the police to report the late-night fireworks. Three officers arrived, and the couple informed them of the altercation that had occurred earlier in the day, to which one officer allegedly responded, quote, "But how do you know it's a hate crime? How is he supposed to know you're gay?" unquote. After this exchange, the Dragoons realized that the police officers, quote, "clearly weren't there to help us," unquote. The couple believes the owners are new to the neighborhood because they do not previously recall seeing them when they often walk through the neighborhood with their two kids. Wendy also expressed that, quote, "I don't feel safe in my own home anymore. It wouldn't take them long to find out where we live," unquote. In response to this incident, community members have decorated the street outside the neighbor's home with chalk rainbows, hearts, and positive messages.
In regards to LGBTQ rights, a new Gay and Trans Panic Defense Prohibition Act has been introduced in Congress. Democratic Senator Edward Markey and Representative Joe Kennedy, both of Massachusetts, are pushing legislation that would end the use of so-called gay panic or trans panic defenses in federal court. The legislation comes that these controversial defenses, quote, "seek to partially or completely excuse crimes such as murder and assault on the grounds that the sexual orientation or gender identity of the victim is provocation enough for the violent reaction of the defendant," unquote. This defense tactic has already been banned in California and Illinois, yet is still theoretically admissible in federal court. Senator Markey said in a statement, quote, "Gay and trans panic legal defenses reflect an irrational fear and bigotry towards LGBTQ community and corrode the legitimacy of federal prosecutions. These defenses must be prohibited to ensure that all Americans are treated with dignity and humanity in our justice system," unquote. Representative Kennedy states that, quote, "murdering or assaulting an individual because of their sexual orientation or gender identity is not a defense, it is a hate crime," unquote. According to a 2016 report by the Williams Institute at UCLA Law, gay and trans panic defenses have appeared in court opinions in approximately 50% of states since the 1960s. With the Gay and Trans Panic Defense Prohibition Act, Congress is taking a step that the legal community has been urging for years. In addition to Markey and Kennedy, the bill has 10 co-sponsors in the House and 5 in the Senate, including Senator Tammy Baldwin, the Senate's only LGBTQ member.
The band Pussy Riot has won a court case against the government of Russia. The European Court of Human Rights ordered the country to pay the female punk ensemble about $57,000 in damages because of treatment the band has endured from the Russian government. Back in 2012, the band members were charged with hooliganism after playing a song of protest inside a church in Moscow. Two of the band members spent close to 2 years each in prison before being given amnesty in December of 2013. The European Court of Human Rights said that the women have been subjected to humiliating and overly severe treatment. The women who were previously imprisoned, Maria Alyokina and Nadezhda Tolokonikova, said that they had been forced into gynecological examinations every few weeks while in prison. In today's ruling, the European Court determined that sentencing the women to imprisonment for simply wearing brightly colored clothing and waving their arms and kicking their legs while using strong language, without analyzing the lyrics of their song or the context of their performance, was exceptionally and excessively severe.
Pussy Riot continues to demand the release of band members Olga Patusova and Olga Kurdicheva, Nika Nikolshina, and Petya Versilov from their 15-day term from their Police Enters the Game action during the World Cup. Right after the beginning of the second half of the France vs. Croatia soccer match, Pussy Riot members, dressed in white shirts and black ties, invaded the pitch in order to draw attention to a statement the band shared in which members spoke about the difference between the fair and just, quote, "heavily policemen" and the oppressive, quote, "earthly policemen." The action also drew attention to the band's new song and video titled Track About Good Cop. The video stars several men and one woman dressed in Russian police uniforms who dance near multiple locations, including a police car and snow-covered home. The track incidentally dropped today, the same day as the European Court and Human Rights ruling.
Today, Newsweek wrote about an art gallery in Portland criticized for displaying a piece of artwork on the window that depicts President Donald Trump's throat being cut with a knife, with explicit words underneath. The photo of the artwork surfaced on Twitter on Tuesday, with many people slamming the gallery for posting the violent image. Rebecca Worsham tweeted on Tuesday, quote, "You know, it would be a shame if America lit them up and told them what they thought, wouldn't it? Or maybe the Secret Service paid them a visit," unquote. The gallery hosted an opening reception to their exhibition on Friday, showing dozens of artists' work from across the country. Kurt McCaffrey, on the gallery's Facebook page, wrote, quote, "The depiction on the window of our president being beheaded is disgraceful and actually dangerous, and a pretty sad example to the young kids walking by your establishment. I hope your business gets shut down immediately," unquote. The gallery's Yelp page has also been flooded with one-star reviews and comments about the artwork. Some commenters noted the extremely graphic nature of the work, while others called the decal disgusting.
The Beaverton Center for the Arts has been a long time in the making. Thanks to a massive $13 million donation by the Resser family, the center is coming even closer to become a reality. The family is known for Resser Fine Foods, which is headquartered in Beaverton and employs 4,800 people across the U.S., Canada, and Mexico. The Oregonian reports on Tuesday that following the donation toward the 550-seat theater, the project will be renamed the Patricia Resser Center for the Arts. According to Patricia Resser, quote, "This center will be a place to celebrate artistic expression in all its forms. My hope is that it will help artists and art flourish and will impact residents positively for generations to come," unquote. Since 2004, a large theater space has been a top priority in Beaverton. Currently, the center will include the 550-seat theater, meeting, conference, rehearsal, and classroom space, as well as workshop areas, an art gallery, an outdoor plaza, cafe, lobby, parking structure, and other informal areas. The center will be located near the light rail line close to Southwest Cedar Hills Boulevard and Southwest Hall Boulevard. Lonnie Faith, executive director of the Beaverton Arts Foundation, states that, quote, "I really believe we have a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to transform this community," unquote. The center is still being designed, but the groundbreaking ceremony is planned for winter 2019, and the grand opening is projected for spring 2021. According to Faith, quote, "We want to be sure that our programming reflects our community. Beaverton is one of the most diverse cities in the state of Oregon, and I think we have a lot to celebrate in that."
Angela Hernandez was driving from Portland on July 6th to visit family in Southern California when she disappeared after telling relatives she was 6 hours away. The 23-year-old woman fell 200 feet off a California cliff while driving her Jeep and remained lost and injured for a week, according to a missing persons report from the Monterey County Sheriff's Office. A week later, hikers found Hernandez's mangled white Jeep at the bottom of a massive cliff near Big Sur on Friday, July 13th. Nearby, they found Hernandez, dehydrated and injured. Hernandez revealed that a small animal stepped onto the road, causing her to swerve and lose control of the vehicle. Hernandez stated, quote, "I don't really remember much of the fall. I just remember waking up still in my car, and I could feel water rising over my knees. My head hurt, and when I touched it, I found blood on my hands. Every bone in my body hurt. The only thing racing through my mind was my sister, Isabel, so I started screaming her name," unquote. Hernandez posted a lengthy Facebook post describing the entire situation. She wrote, quote, "Every day this became my ritual. I'd walk up and down the beach looking for new high grounds, screaming help at the top of my lungs and collecting water falling from the top of the cliffs. Every night, I'd find the highest point I could climb up to and find somewhere to fall asleep before the tide would rise." Eventually, a rescue team pulled Hernandez to safety and a helicopter took her to a hospital nearby. Hernandez said she suffered a brain hemorrhage in the crash, fractured four ribs, broke both collarbones, suffered a collapsed lung, had ruptured blood vessels in both eyes, and received intense sunburns on her hands, feet, and face.
Pendleton residents noted something suspicious in the sky last week for approximately an hour. "The white object stayed in one spot," said Virgil Bates Jr., a construction worker who was recording. Many onlookers thought it was something like a plastic bag or kite, but the object was not resisting wind like plastic bag or a kite would have. A local airport, which is in partnership with the Pendleton UAS range, claims that they tested one of their projects early in the morning, but nothing else was scheduled for testing later on that day. Another floating object similar to the white object made its way into sight as well. The object reportedly fluttered into the original and then zoomed off into a straight line towards over McKay Creek, reports KGW.com. The original white object then disappeared, remaining a mystery.
The plan for a new building in downtown Portland is coming to an end. The framework building was designed to be 12 stories, including a roof deck, and was to be constructed from cross-laminated timber. This is an innovative lumber product made by gluing sheets of wood together. However, the building has faced a funding shortfall despite significant pledges of public dollars. The structure would have been a record-setting wooden Portland tower that was expected to be the tallest in North America. It would have included 60 affordable apartments and was projected to cost $651 per square foot. One 660-square-foot two-bedroom apartment was projected to cost a total of $567,389 to build. A representative from City Hall stated that the cost of the project proved to be too high. Despite Mayor Ted Wheeler pledging to bring down the cost of housing in Portland, the Portland Housing Bureau nonetheless awarded the building $6 million towards the $29 million total. The Housing Bureau justified the decision to spend urban renewal dollars on the project in part by saying the project was ready to go, including funding. However, this proved untrue as the building faced a $2 million funding gap. A statement tonight from the developer blamed, quote, market challenges, unquote, for the decision not to move forward with the project. They did not address the fact that the project has had a funding deficit since last year.
According to the Oregon Employment Department, in June of this year, the unemployment rate in Oregon dropped to its lowest point since record-keeping began in 1976. While the low jobless rate is certainly a cause for excitement, these exact numbers are preliminary. In 2017, Oregon reported even lower record-breaking unemployment rates for a number of months, but eventually revised these numbers at the end of the year. The recent data from last month could be subjected to a similar fate. However, the fact that the record low numbers could change does not discredit the continual steady growth of Oregon's economy. In addition to the low unemployment rate, long-term unemployment numbers, meaning people who have been looking for a job for 27 weeks or more, is also at a record low and less than 77,000 people. This is in a sharp contrast to data collected in 2010 following the Great Recession, which showed that more than 100,000 Oregonians were affected by long-term unemployment. The rate of part-time workers who would rather be in a full-time position is also at an all-time low. The unemployment rate, which is also known as the U6 rate, is at its lowest record point in 16 years. Despite record low unemployment rates, Oregon economic growth has plateaued in what economists call, quote, full employment. According to Oregon Live, in the past 12 months, the growth rates of jobs in Oregon have equated to 1.6%, meaning that there has been an additional 31,400 jobs added to the market. In comparison to 3.4% of growth rate of 3 years ago, the current rate has been cut nearly in half. Additionally, Oregon business owners have claimed to be struggling to find qualified candidates for open positions. In an analysis published by the State of Oregon, economist John Lehner said, quote, "The pattern of job vacancies overall reflects a strong economy in which businesses are having a harder time filling positions, but at least not yet due to legitimate labor market problems," unquote. This signifies that there is no need for concern at this time.
And now, it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Trump administration has reopened a decades-long fight over land into trust in Alaska. Jacob Resnick reports.
When Native American tribes put land into trust with the federal government, it gives it special status. It's not subject to most local and state laws. It's not taxed either. These lands in the lower 48 are commonly known as Indian country. And for decades, Alaska tribes weren't able to do this. The Department of Interior cited 1971's Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act as the reason. Ivan Ensaluski is the Nanilchik Village Tribe's top official.
We did not receive land from the federal government, so we're kind of at a loss to our Aboriginal land claims.
The tribe decided to put its bus garage into trust. That would exempt it from local and state taxes and potentially unlock further federal money. The tribe had reason to be optimistic. After more than a decade of litigation, the Bureau of Indian Affairs began accepting lands into trust applications from Alaska tribes in 2014. This June, tribes were notified the rule was being withdrawn. Anchorage attorney Lloyd Miller helped sue the Department of Interior. That eventually opened the way for Alaska's tribes to put lands into trust.
The White House has made it clear that anything associated with President Obama is to be questioned and presumptively reversed. And the White House has taken that to heart. The agencies have taken it to heart. And this is certainly part of that directive.
It's unclear where Governor Bill Walker's administration stands. Alaska Native leaders that advise Walker recently met over the federal government's sudden U-turn. Melissa Borton chairs the governor's Tribal Advisory Council. She said the feeling among that group is that when it comes to putting lands into trust, the so-called Alaska exception is unfair.
If tribes feel the need and see the importance in putting that land into trust, then they should have that opportunity just like every other tribe in the nation has. We should not be treated differently than the lower 48 tribes.
In the meantime, Alaska Native tribes have invested thousands of dollars in their applications. In Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
The Canadian government is partnering with 14 First Nations to help protect the country's Pacific North Coast. As Dan Karpinchuk reports, the Prime Minister announced the agreement.
The agreement covers about two-thirds of the British Columbia coast, and it will involve coordinating management and conservation of the ocean as well as developing a network of protected marine areas. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says it's an important agreement for both reconciliation and environmental protection in Canada.
Today, we celebrate Canada's first ever Reconciliation Framework Agreement for Bioregional Oceans Management and Protection, which involves 14 First Nations along the Pacific coast. This is an important commitment to regional partnership in the task of ocean management.
The region along the Pacific teems with marine life. It's also the scene of significant shipping. Trudeau says the work will include waterway management, increase emergency preparedness, and increase the response capacity of local First Nations. But the announcement comes as Ottawa faces criticism over the controversial Trans Mountain pipeline, which would carry Alberta oil to the Pacific coast. Critics fear that would increase the possibility of accidents both along the pipeline or with the boost in tanker traffic along the waterways. But those First Nations to take part say it's an important step because it gives their communities a leadership role. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
The U.S. Senate Committee on Indian Affairs and the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration are hosting an Indian Voting Rights Roundtable Tuesday in Washington, D.C. Tribal and state leaders will join members of the committees to discuss voting rights, access, and barriers in Indian country. Native rights advocates are also expected to take part in the roundtable. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on automated vehicles with KBOO reporter Emmett White. At 6, it's the Queerboo Corner. Then at 7, it's Calculated Conversations. Tonight's weather, mostly clear at 61 degrees with humidity at 54% and a few passing clouds. There are winds north to northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour and a 10% chance of rainfall. Tomorrow in Portland, the Dallas, and Hood River highs will reach near 100 degrees. Expect much cooler weather in Lincoln City with highs of 67 degrees. Today in history, on July 17, 1955, the Disneyland theme park opened its gates for the first time. And the quote of the day is from Ferris Bueller's Day Off, quote, "Life moves pretty fast. If you don't stop and look around every once in a while, you could miss it."
Earlier today, Britain's Electoral Commission, an electoral watchdog, fined the pro-Brexit campaign Vote Leave £61,000, or about $80,000, for violating campaign spending rules. The electoral watchdog also referred two people involved in the campaign to British police. The Brexit referendum dealt with the issue of whether or not the United Kingdom should leave the European Union. The 2016 vote ended with 52% choosing to leave the bloc, while 48% wanted to stay. The Electoral Commission argues that by coordinating with another group, which gave hundreds of thousands to a firm linked to the infamous Cambridge Analytica, the Vote Leave campaign exceeded the £7 million spending limit by almost 500,000 pounds. This is just the latest of multiple investigations into how Cambridge Analytica affected the 2016 referendum. The Information Commissioner's Office, the UK's data watchdog, has an ongoing investigation into whether the Vote Leave campaign violated data protection law by transferring British citizens' personal data outside of the UK. Similarly, Britain's budget watchdog is investigating the campaign's claim that Brexit would lead to a surplus in funds, which would then be used for the country's National Health Service. The watchdog stated, quote, "Brexit is more likely to weaken the public finances than strengthen them," unquote, adding that the extra financing would instead have to come from increased taxation or economic borrowing. Fair Vote UK, a group that campaigns for electoral transparency, argues that the results of the investigation indicate that the Brexit referendum is, quote, "now illegitimate," unquote. Although various politicians have called for a second vote, including Justine Greening, a former member of UK Prime Minister Theresa May's cabinet, May has categorically ruled out another Brexit vote, quote, "under any circumstances," unquote.
On Sunday, at least 10 protesters were killed in Nicaragua by police and paramilitary units. The head of the Nicaraguan Pro-Human Rights Association, Alvaro Leiva, said that over 20 people were also wounded. Protesters are opposing the administration of President Daniel Ortega and demand that he be removed from office. These deaths follow an extremely violent weekend involving armed attacks against more than 200 university students. The students have peacefully occupied the National Autonomous University of Nicaragua for 2 months of protests against President Ortega's administration. After being forced out by police and paramilitary units, the students sought refuge in a local church. At the Jesus of Divine Mercy Church, students came under gunfire over 12 hours and two students were killed. The attack by police was televised on local media outlets and through Facebook Live. The students and journalists can be found huddled on the floor as bullets fly throughout this church. Many students send farewell messages to family and friends. In a video that went viral, a crying student is heard saying, quote, "I did it for the country and I don't regret it. Forgive me, Mama. I love you," unquote. 20-year-old student Gerald Vasquez was one of the two students killed on Saturday. At his funeral, attendees chanted while carrying his casket, quote, "They were students, they weren't delinquents," unquote. The Nicaraguan police have not issued an official statement about the incident. Unrest in Nicaragua has escalated this spring after the government announced its cuts to Social Security. However, the cuts were quickly reversed after students took to the streets in protest. The political crisis have left about 270 people dead and over 2,000 wounded as the government has cracked down on political opposition. President Ortega has rejected calls to move up to the 2021 elections and instead have labeled the protesters as coup mongers. Earlier this month, the U.S. government directed all non-emergency personnel to leave Nicaragua as violence mounted. Last night, the U.S. State Department issued a statement condemning the ongoing violence in Nicaragua. The spokeswoman, Heather Nauert, said, quote, "We call on Ortega to cease his repression of the people of Nicaragua immediately. The Nicaraguan government must heed the Nicaraguan people's call for democratic reforms immediately. Early, free, fair, and transparent elections are the best path to democracy and respect for human rights in Nicaragua," unquote. The UN also issued a statement that, quote, "The use of lethal force is not only unacceptable, but is also in itself an obstacle to obtaining a political solution to the current crisis."
In 1990, a message scribbled on the front of a barn door 2 years after the abduction, murder, and rape of 8-year-old April Tinsley read, quote, "I kill 8-year-old April M. Tinsley. Did you find her other shoe? I will kill again," unquote. 30 years later, the murderer has been caught. Genealogy and DNA tests recently determined that the killer of 8-year-old Tinsley was 59-year-old John D. Miller. Years after murdering the child, Miller continued to write semi-illiterate and threatening letters to locals in the Fort Wayne, Illinois area. In one handwritten letter, Miller wrote, quote, "Hi, honey. I've been watching you. I am the same person that kidnapped and raped and killed April Tinsley," unquote. Miller then continues, quote, "You are my next victim," unquote. The letters came in baggies with used condoms and photos of Miller's corpse. Police later used those condoms in DNA testing, which led them to a match with Miller. When confronted and asked by officers of Gravel, Indiana, why they were there to speak to him, Miller replied, quote, "April Tinsley," unquote. Miller admitted to raping Tinsley, choking her until death, and then having intercourse with the corpse. Miller also admitted to dumping the body at a location 20 miles away. Miller has been charged with murder, child molestation, and criminal confinement of a victim under 14 years old. Miller will not be eligible to be released on bail.
The state of California will now officially recognize the month of June as Pride Month. Yesterday, the governor of the state of California, Jerry Brown, signed a bill that makes California the first state in the U.S. with a state law that acknowledges June as Pride Month. Assemblymember Evan Lowe and the California Legislative LGBT Caucus, a group that is also chaired by Lowe, created the bill with support from Equality California and the Los Angeles LGBT Center. Lowe and other supporters wrote the bill to officially secure the holiday, rather than having government officials proclaim June as Pride Month every year.
Same-sex marriage is now allowed in all Episcopal churches in the U.S. after delegates of the church accepted a resolution to let same-sex couples get married in any parish. In 2015, Episcopal churches allowed same-sex weddings at nearly all churches besides eight. However, members of the clergy as well as bishops of the church can refuse to perform marriages. However, they can easily be replaced by another bishop who will accommodate the same-sex couple. States and cities where Episcopal churches did not permit same-sex marriages were Albany, New York, Springfield, Illinois, Tennessee, the Virgin Islands, two areas in Florida, Dallas, Texas, and North Dakota.
MGM Resorts International, the company that owns the Mandalay Bay Resort and Casino in Las Vegas, is asking federal courts to maintain that if not liable for the mass shooting that occurred in October last year, the gunman Stephen Paddock was staying at the Mandalay Bay Resort for several days before he opened fire to Route 91 Harvest Music Festival from his hotel room window. He killed 58 people and injured hundreds more. Many of the victims of the shooting have previously filed lawsuits in state court against Mandalay Bay. In response, MGM Resorts International has filed lawsuits against the victims. The lawsuit names over 800 defendants in California and another 200 in Nevada. The defendants are victims of the shooting who threaten lawsuits against MGM Resorts or those who previously bought lawsuits that have since been dismissed. MGM Resorts argues that the secretary company of the festival provided a variety of preventative measures which were certified by the Department of Homeland Security. Because of this, they assert that the hotel has no liability in the mass shooting. The lawsuit notes, quote, "No MGM party attempted to commit, knowingly participated in, aided, abetted, committed, or participated in any conspiracy to commit any act of terrorism," unquote. This is comparable to the lawsuits that followed the Aurora Movie Theater mass shooting in 2012. Victims filed a lawsuit against the theater chain, Cinemark, but lost the case and were then ordered by the court to pay the company's legal fees. Similarly, lawsuits that attempt to hold gun manufacturers themselves liable for mass shootings have historically also been unsuccessful. Las Vegas lawyer Robert Eglett, who was representing several of the victims, told the Las Vegas Review-Journal that the MGM lawsuit is a preemptive strike in order to have the cases tried in federal rather than state court. Eglett also speculates that MGM believes it has better chance of winning the case than if it appears in federal court. MGM's response to this assertion is that, quote, "The federal court is an appropriate venue for these cases and provides those affected with the opportunity for a timely resolution. Years of drawn-out litigation and hearings are not in the best interest of victims, the community, and those still healing."
In a recent interview with PBS News, Democratic congressional candidate Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez referred to Israeli settlements in the West Bank as, quote, "an occupation," unquote. Ocasio-Cortez's remarks deviate substantially from the historic stances regarding Israel of both the Democratic and Republican parties in the U.S. According to the UN, Israel has been occupying the West Bank territory since the Middle East War in 1967. Most countries around the world regard the continued construction of Israeli settlements in the West Bank as illegal. For the last 20 years, establishment Democrats and Republicans have maintained a pro-Israel stance. In the past, both parties have called for Jerusalem to be regarded as Israel's capital. In her interview with PBS, Ocasio-Cortez states that, quote, "What people are starting to see, at least in the occupation of Palestine, is just an increasing crisis of humanitarian condition," unquote. When asked to expand, Ocasio-Cortez continues, quote, "What I mean is the settlements that are increasing in some of these areas and places where Palestinians are experiencing difficulty in access to their housing," unquote. Ocasio-Cortez maintains that, quote, "I am not the expert on the geopolitical issue. I am a firm believer in finding a two-state solution on the issue. I just look at things through a human rights lens, unquote. Hillel Neuer, director of the United Nations Watch and an Israeli advocate, responded to Ocasio-Cortez's comments by calling her a, quote, teen Vogue fave, unquote. He continued by stating that PBS's questions, quote, expose the silliness of politicians, unquote. Ocasio-Cortez is a rising Democratic star after defeating Democrat Joe Crowley, a 10-term incumbent in their June primary. She has made a name for herself by deviating from Democratic establishment norms. She also made similar comments about the Israeli army's massacre of Palestinian protesters in May. Referring to the massacre, Ocasio-Cortez asserts that, quote, there is no justification. Palestinian people deserve basic human dignity as anyone else. Democrats can't be silent about this anymore, unquote. Ocasio-Cortez drew parallels between the Palestinian protesters and civil rights activists in the U.S., stating, quote, I could only imagine if 60 people were shot and killed in Ferguson, or if 60 people were shot and killed in the West Virginia teacher strike. The idea that we are not supposed to talk about people dying when they are engaging in political expression really moved me, unquote. Ocasio-Cortez will compete for her place in Congress this November, and her strong grassroots support gives her a high chance of being elected into office.
And now it's time to cleanse your palate of the madness. It's the Point Puzzle.
It's time for the puzzle.
Last week, I asked you to name a U.S. city, population over 200,000, whose name can be spelled using only the music syllables do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, and ti. Well, the answer is Laredo, Texas, and our winner this week is Daryl McKeel, who listens to KYAQ in Newport, Oregon. Let's stay with the music syllable theme one more week. For the new puzzle, start with a country, remove the last letter, and then read the remaining letters backwards, and you will again have music syllables. So again, start with a country, remove the last letter, and then the remaining letters backwards are made up of the music syllables do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, or ti. When you have the answer, send your name, your answer, and the station on which you hear the puzzle to puzzle@kpov.org. I'll select one winner from among any answers received by this Saturday. And if you have a puzzle you'd like to suggest, send that along too.
Now the police at the port of entry say, your number 14,000 for today. Yeah, if you ain't got the door.
This has been Pearl Stark with your Point Puzzle for the week of July 16th. The Point Puzzle is produced at KPOV High Desert Community Radio.
Three killings were carried out in the last few days in Houston, Texas, and law enforcement might have caught the suspect. Jose Gilberto Rodriguez, a registered sex offender, parolee, and suspect of the murders of three people, was placed under arrest and taken into custody by law enforcement after a Houston resident noticed a suspicious vehicle. The resident called local law enforcement and reported the Nissan Sentra that police said the potential murderer was driving. Law enforcement arrested Rodriguez after a small pursuit. Rodriguez was on parole but had cut off his ankle monitor prior to the killings. There is currently no known motive for the murders. Two of the three bodies were discovered at two separate mattress stores. The first victim was a 62-year-old woman who was murdered in her own home. Family members became suspicious and notified authorities after her disappearance. Rodriguez then stole the victim's car and drove to a nearby mall where he abandoned the vehicle. There is a possibility that Rodriguez is also responsible for robbing a bus as well as shooting at a random driver.
Per Vice News, on Monday, the Trump administration was dealt a blow when U.S. District Judge Dana Sobral blocked any parent currently separated from their children from being deported. The temporary block lasted for the next 7 days. Another U.S. District Judge, Victor Bolden, handed down a ruling on Friday requiring the Trump administration to deliver a long-term plan to treat PTSD in two children separated from their parents. The Department of Health and Human Services personnel and ICE officials are scrambling to meet a July 26 deadline to reunite 2,551 children ages 5 to 17 who are currently being detained away from their parents. HHS and ICE officials have 9 days to meet the deadline and must confirm parents' identities and check their criminal histories in order to reunite families. 1,317 parents have been cleared, while 71 parents have not been identified. HHS did not comment on why they could not locate 71 parents. As HHS and ICE attempt to reunite all children 5 and older with their parents, they have already failed to meet the deadline to reunite all children younger than 5 with their parents. Of 103 children younger than 5 who were being detained, 46 remain in detention centers separated from their parents. These children are still being held due to claims about their parents' criminal histories, as well as doubts over whether they are actually related to their parents, among other reasons.
Repercussions for family separations are mounting higher and higher for the Trump administration. 2 children who require treatment for PTSD after being separated from their parents were reunited with their families on Monday. Both children will appear in court on Wednesday to review possible treatments. Yale Law School will provide the legal team that will represent the children. The legal team intends to argue that every child forcibly separated from their parents be treated for their subsequent trauma, and that the government is responsible to provide that treatment. Asim Mehta, a law student who is helping on the case, says, quote, "The government has deliberately inflicted this pain and suffering on these families. Part of the reason why our clients were released is because the order we received takes seriously the trauma the government has inflicted on these children. Reunification and release, that's not enough," unquote. While the number of traumatized children still separated from their parents remains in the thousands, Judge Sabrow, who handed down the 7-day halt on deportations for parents, has criticized the government's screening process. On Monday, Sabrow asserted that the government is, quote, failing, unquote, to screen parents effectively. Sabrow's halt on deportations of parents who have not been reunited with their children is based on concerns first raised by the ACLU, that parents would have to decide whether to be deported alone or with their children without being allowed to talk about their options with their family or a lawyer. Prior to Sabrow's ruling, 12 parents of children under the age of 5 were deported without being reunited with their children. The government intends to reunify 200 kids aged 5 to 17 with their parents every day by transporting the children to 8 ICE facilities. By July 19th, ICE and HHS are required to have vetted all parents in ICE custody before updating the court on their progress on July 20th.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us for your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Emmett White, CJ Fritz, Yasmin Kabanoglu, Lucas Campbell, Summer Barraza, and Sophia Wilson. The producer, engineer, and the KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelocelis Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, and 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Kyle Carrezzi.
And I'm Yasmin. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio. At 9, Project Censored talks to investigative journalist Peter Byrne about the anatomy of terrorism and the roots of white nationalism. At 10, Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:30, Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, The Food Show keeps you on top of the news and issues surrounding the food on your plate. All of these KBOO programs are made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm and click on Donate.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We speak with KBOO's own news reporter, Emmett White, about the Oregon Department of Transportation's task force on autonomous vehicles. Hi, Emmett.
Hey.
So, what exactly are autonomous vehicles?
That's a great question to begin with, because I think there's a lot of confusion out there about autonomous vehicles and what they actually are, especially with you kind of see Tesla's autopilot system. So autonomous vehicles, when defining them as fully autonomous, are vehicles that can act independently of human control. And there are currently there's currently a specific way that legislators are using to kind of form what ways they're going to regulate autonomous vehicles. And this is defined by the Society of Automotive Engineers. So there's five levels. There's level 0 through 1, and zero through five. And currently in Oregon, we're looking to regulate autonomous vehicles from a level 3 and up, which means that it'd be a conditional automation level 3, high automation level 4, and full automation level 5.
So what are the main points that the task force laid out in this testing in Oregon?
So the task force in Oregon was subdivided into 4 different subcommittees. There's licensing and registration, law enforcement, insurance and liability, and cybersecurity. So each subcommittee was tasked with a certain kind of way in which they're going to regulate autonomous vehicles. So, for example, licensing and registration, which had the most meat of the substance, was really about kind of figuring out how they're going to permit these vehicles on the road. So contact information, vehicle information, driver information, prior testing, safety requirements, reporting requirements, fees and fines, stuff like that. In particular, they're trying to figure out who would be driving these vehicles, kind of if they'd be employees of the company, through the government. The law enforcement side of it was they're trying to create a first responders plan to see how they would pull the vehicle over if they had to, how to disengage autonomous mode, interaction with hybrid or electric vehicles if necessary, and how to safely remove an autonomous vehicle from the roadway. And after that, the insurance and liability subcommittee and the cybersecurity subcommittee kind of slimmed down what they were recommending. But insurance was looking to have a $5 million umbrella insurance policy, which it goes above and beyond the traditional auto insurance policy, which would also be required on each autonomous vehicle. But this covers even more bodily damage, property damage, and covers more of your liability, as well as they were trying to figure out who would be presented with the data based on the testing. And they actually believed that at the subcommittee meeting that this data would be public record as well. And finally, the cybersecurity subcommittee was just talking about meeting appropriate and applicable current industry standards, and they're actually utilizing California's language on this.
Do you know what kind of vetting other states do when they bring in autonomous cars to let them on the road? We did just mention California.
Yeah, so California is probably the best state to look at in that California has a very strict subset of requirements, in that not only do they take on this kind of contact information, vehicle information stuff, but they have a very stringent policy on making sure the drivers of those vehicles know when autonomous mode is engaged and disengaged in order to accurately figure out who's driving the car at the time and prevent accidents like we saw in Arizona.
And you were mentioning the different levels of autonomy. What's the difference between level 3 and level 5?
All right, yeah. So level 5 is pretty much that the car can drive itself under most conditions. However, the human is the fallback for that. Mm-hmm. So if there's a dynamic situation, say, a quick turn or a quick braking under low traction circumstances, the human would have to take over. Whereas level 4 and 5 is that level 4, you get away from the human on the fallback, and that in almost all cases, the human is not necessary. Where that level 5, this is like full, driving acceleration, deceleration, as well as constant dynamic driving avoidance solutions coming into play.
Okay.
So what do you see as the benefits or the drawbacks of having autonomous vehicles on the roads in Oregon?
Yeah, well, I mean, just in general, on autonomous vehicles, there's this kind of great safety thing that we can possibly look forward to in the future, is that there's 37,000 traffic deaths a year in the United States. And if implemented properly, autonomous vehicles could limit this by removing human error. And also, for Portland specifically, at the subcommittee meeting, a Daimler official said that they had chosen Portland as their hub for autonomous vehicle or autonomous commercial vehicle testing. So it's kind of going to add another economic driving force here. However, I guess, I mean, for Oregonians, it's going to be starting to interact with autonomous vehicles and having to figure out how, at certain times, especially now, we're going to have roadways with normal drivers, human drivers, as well as autonomous vehicles.
I also noticed that although there are taxi cab, trucking, cybersecurity, and environmental interests represented in the membership of the task force, I don't see anyone that represents the views of Oregon's many pedestrians and cyclists. Is this something that the task force is planning on addressing?
At this particular meeting, it was not actually addressed. However, I believe it's most certainly something they're planning on addressing, because as we saw in Arizona, there was a tragic accident that happened with an autonomous vehicle and a biker. And I think I don't want to add too much emphasis on this accident, because while it was tragic, we have to acknowledge that there are a certain amount of human-driven traffic deaths per year, as well as the company Uber that was working with that autonomous technology was not the most, and they even said themselves, they hadn't developed their technology as much as other companies such as Google and Tesla had before. So it was kind of them working through the kinks, and unfortunately led to a tragic death.
Now, I guess from a company standpoint, what do they still have to test about autonomous vehicles? Because you did mention people still have to learn how to interact with these vehicles on the road. Mm-hmm. So what kind of things do they have to be tested still? Before they're consumer ready, I should say.
Yeah, so that's a great question. That was brought up. So currently, the way that they were going out about it is just for testing, not for deployment. There's testing, which is just vetting the automation systems capabilities in the real world, and then there's deployment. So right now they're just trying to see how it interacts with roadways, your poorly paved roadways and load tracks and situations, and even, you know, if a driver cuts them off, how they interact with that. Whereas with deployment, it'll be they've already vetted through every possible problem they could, and then actually allowed these vehicles out onto the roadway for consumers.
So did they have the task force, do they have any long-term goals in regarding the autonomous vehicles in Oregon?
Certainly, yeah. They were just trying to figure out, first, like I said, testing, but deployment is the big thing, getting these vehicles into consumers. I mean, we currently have Tesla's system, which is a level 2 system, and in that means that the human is still required to monitor the driving environment. And while the car can perform certain tasks, the human will often be asked to take control. And I think with this long-term testing, they're looking to figure out how they can certify that the testing is done adequately to ensure the safety of Oregonians to then go into deployment. And they even acknowledge that, you know, this isn't that far in the future, but in order to keep the roads safe, Oregon's going to be someplace that maybe lags a little bit behind other states, but has more vetted safety structures.
So will there be a day where we will only have autonomous vehicles on the road in Portland? Is there a time frame that you can give us for that?
That's kind of a hard question to answer in some cases, because it really depends on who you're talking to. Some companies say they could have fully autonomous vehicles by 2020 or 2025, like Google and Tesla were talking about that. However, many safety advocates or even lots of auto enthusiasts believe that this is not possible, because of the fact that so many people are, you know, set to commuting in their cars individually each day, as well as the fact that autonomous technology is most certainly going to be applicable to new cars and not readily available for those who cannot afford new cars.
And can you talk a bit more about the Society of Automotive Engineers?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the Society of Automotive Engineers is a society, obviously, of automotive engineers, but they really take pride in working with the safety of our current automotive standards, both within autonomous technology as well as current technology. So they've been instrumental in providing studies throughout the eras of automotive technology advancement, and how these safety features like seatbelts, airbags, and anti-lock brakes affect vehicle safety, and how we've gone from, you know, having unsafe at any speeds published to now having a fairly, you know, a new car being extraordinarily more safe than an older car.
Mm-hmm. And so why do you think that this type of technology is really important for us today?
Certainly. So I think, like I said, there's a solution to traffic deaths, and that's, you know, it's a debatable one. We haven't seen the hard data on how a fully autonomous vehicle will run throughout the roadways, but there's also the idea of a solution to emissions for a few reasons, in that it's speculated that many autonomous vehicles, as we move forward with vehicle technology in general, will be electric or hybrid, which could most certainly lower the emissions rate that we currently have, as well as the way in which autonomous vehicles drive. And this is getting even to more kind of nerdy, like human being patterns. But if there's certain driving patterns that you can instill into autonomous vehicles or code into autonomous vehicles that have for more gentle braking or more gentle acceleration, that itself can even lower emissions rate or emissions levels. And then there's the counterpoint to the emissions, in that they say that if everyone is driving these autonomous vehicles all the time and not actually having to drive themselves, the burden of driving will be taken away. So there could be more miles driven by car. And if these cars were to be gasoline powered and not electric, it could add to emissions.
And is autonomy being tested in other types of machinery, whether like maybe say like something like planes or something, or different types of machinery in factories or something like that?
This was actually brought up a few times by a member of the subcommittee, and specifically they were talking about how they believe this could be implemented in, like you said, factories or even farm work, in that farmers or factory workers would be able to use these autonomous machines to really quicken the pace at which they do things.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that maybe could be implemented into public transportation, like autonomous buses or subways and things like that?
Certainly, yeah. That was kind of something that they put on the back burner at the subcommittee, but I think is definitely something to explore, because as we move into a new age in which we're trying to lower our global impact, is that not only are people be using cars, but people will be using public transportation, or they should be using public transportation more often to get places.
And then are there any specific companies that have targeted Oregon for testing yet of the autonomous vehicles?
Besides Daimler, like I said, they're looking to do a bunch of commercial autonomous vehicle testing, and that even gets into another kind of sector in which, instead of having these long distance truckers that we currently have, we could have autonomous vehicles moving things back and forth without even an operator in them. Well, other than that, I mean, the traditional companies that are doing it right now that haven't specifically targeted Oregon but will most certainly come as our legislation is updated is like Waymo, Google, Ford, Mercedes-Benz, GM. All those companies have already been working with technology that allows for radar adaptive cruise control and their own testing of autonomous vehicles. And as Oregon becomes a more friendly place to test autonomous vehicles, I'm certain that those companies will be coming as well.
And as we're gearing up to wrap up this segment soon, is there anything you want to add?
I think that just people shouldn't necessarily be scared of autonomous vehicles. As myself, being a very avid car enthusiast and you know, owning old cars and being into the whole driving myself, I think autonomous vehicles are most certainly something that people should be excited about and not be scared about the future even after this accident. You have to put that into perspective and say that as the future of autonomous vehicles progresses, and as people like Oregon actually take the time to sit down over four or five meetings with legislators to discuss the safety of it, it's most certainly going to become a more safe and possibly more environmentally friendly way of getting around.
Yeah, well, Emmett, thanks for stopping by and chatting with us.
Thank you, guys.
Good afternoon. The time is 5:57, and you are listening to KBO Portland. And up next on the Queerbee Corner with This Way Out, queers confront the U.S. High Court crisis, and also queers on ice. Queer asylum seekers are being trapped by Trump's immigration policies.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is also available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Board meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. the KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month, starting at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Northwest String Summit, July 19th through 22nd at Horning's Hideout in North Plains, Oregon. The Northwest String Summit is celebrating its 17th year as a bluegrass, roots, and Americana music festival. Performers this year include three nights of the Yonder Mountain String Band and Green Sky Bluegrass. Other performers include Andy Hall, the Shook Twins, Horseshoes and Hand Grenades, The Deer, Carolyn Cotter, and many more. Again, that's the Northwest String Summit from July 19th through the 22nd at Horning's Hideout, 21277 Northwest Brunswick Canyon Road in North Plains, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Are folks who have shown themselves and asked for asylum. They're trying to get protection. They're not trying to hide.
We are here because we believe that families belong together. But what are we going to do after today?
What I really want to try to impress on you is to...
This is a little treatise called The Little Red Hen.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. U.S. top court throws wedding bouquet case back to Washington state jurists, Angola grants legal recognition to LGBTQ rights group, and queer asylum seekers caught in Trump's immigration crisis. Those stories and more this week, now that you've tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Michelle Yater.
And I'm...